Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, Canada's first online financial news and research service, providing insider news and knowledge to investors. The website, CanadianInsider.com, home of the Canadian Insider Club. You can find them on Twitter at InkResearch. Welcome back to the show, Ted.
Jim, it's great to be back, and thanks for everyone listening in.
Ted, a summer of sinking sovereign debt markets. What does that mean?
Well, it basically means bond yields are going up, and this week they're going way up, and bond prices are going down. And for so long this year, there's been a debate whether bond prices were going to go up and yields were going to go down because of this recession, which has, you know, been widely predicted. The problem is it just hasn't arrived. Yeah. Or whether bonds are mispriced and should really be higher. And when you think of it, the latest GDP numbers out of the U.S. Have nominal growth in on an annualized basis in the United States still above 6%. So nominal growth is like the real rate that you often hear, like 2% or the like, plus the inflation rate, and it's based off of a deflator that's calculated along with the GDP. But right now in the U.S., it's still running above 6%. So when does the bond market maybe start to think, well, gee, lending money to Uncle Sam at 4% for 10 years when the economy is actually growing on a nominal basis of over 6%, maybe this doesn't make a lot of sense. And after all, I mean, the interest rates that you get on bonds are nominal. So what really matters is sort of the nominal growth that's going on in the economy. So why would you be accepting an interest rate that's below the nominal growth rate? Obviously a lot of people were willing to do it. I was not one, to go there. But now I think there's a rethink going on because of concerns about how much debt is going to be coming out of the U.S. Treasury over the next few years. And this is something we've been talking about for a long time. And, you know, we started building our case for a weaker U.S. dollar in April. And at the time, there was a lot of bullish chatter about the U.S. dollar. The part of the problem that we indicated was the ongoing debt drama. And when the debt ceiling negotiations were going, I don't know if you remember that, Jim, and there was this drama about, would they get enough votes for the House of Representatives to pass a deal. But, the consensus in Wall Street was it didn't matter. It was all going to get done and everything is fine. But lo and behold, what happened this week? Rating agency Fitch downgraded the U.S., and part of their rationale was what? It was because of poor governance and this ongoing drama that goes on with the debt ceiling over and over again. And the debt ceiling dance that went on in Washington in the spring was part of the reason why they downgraded the U.S. So, really got the ball rolling this week and I think it basically has settled the debate whether bond yields are going to go up this year or down. They're going up, and they're going up very strongly. And I think the markets are having to come to realize that, yes, the U.S. government, it is, while it is the reserve currency of the, in the world, it is going to have to issue a lot of debt, and someone is going to have to buy that debt, and that's going to be done through some combination of higher interest rates on the bonds, on the longer bonds, and or a lower dollar. And we don't know what that mix will be and what the market will decide, but the direction on both of those, you know, are basically in opposite directions. Lower dollar, higher rates. Now, you could get an extreme where the rates go up so high that the dollar doesn't have to go down. The dollar goes so low that the rates don't have to go up much. But I suspect it'll be kind of a back and forth in the markets between, you know, some days the rates will go up, some days the dollars will go down. But I think the trend for both will be in opposite directions. So that's, you know, summer of sinking sovereign debt markets. Yes, and maybe the sinking dollar as well. We'll have to see about that. But the Fitch rating agency kind of kicked things off. And however, there was also another central bank that has played a supporting role in all of this, and that is the Bank of Japan. And it surprised market participants just last week when it decided that it would now let its 10-year bond move up from half a percentage point upper limit interest rate to 1%. And in the interim between sort of getting there, they didn't say that, but I'll paraphrase them, but, you know, as the yields kind of head up towards 1%, they will step in to support the market to try and to smooth out interest rate rises so that it doesn't, like, get their elevator up, I guess. They don't want an elevator up. They'd rather take an escalator up to 1%. So we've had these two central banks basically, we have these two public entities, basically the Bank of Japan and the Congress through its spending that's, pushing bond markets now down this summer. And, that's a trend now, I think, that's been established. We saw an early reaction in the gold market. Gold went down. And my theory on that is only theory is that the initial reaction was driven by algorithms. Algorithms are pretty stupid. They're just programmed with certain correlations. They don't adapt to things. You know, they're not like AI driven yet. Some may say they are, but maybe that could be even probably worse given how some of these AI programs are functioning, at least for me. And, you know, Jim, I was actually doing some preparation before this survey, before this interview this week using the Microsoft AI function. And, you know, Microsoft, you know, the one that got everyone excited last week, and I think the market cap of the company went up $150 billion because they indicated they're going to offer some AI functionality into some service products. Anyway, I'm using the Bing one, the one on their browser, and I can assure you, it's not ready. You know, it's like it ended up stopping the conversation because I was, you know, pinpointing that, no, you're giving me the wrong answers. I'm asking for current answers. You're giving me historic answers. So, you know, AI is not ready for prime time yet. It just isn't. And so these algorithms, getting back to the algorithms, they're basically pretty dumb. They've been, you know, they're programmed with correlations. And so what happened early this week when Fitch downgraded the U.S., well, the interest rates on the bonds went up. So these algorithms go, interest rates up, good for dollar. Dollar up, bad for gold, gold down, right? I mean, that's basically what happened initially. And so, yes, there's some fundamental reason that gold would have a headwind when interest rates go up even on the long end, but not to the extent that we've seen, in my opinion. And I think this is all going to just burn. I think there's already signs that it's burnt out. And fine, you know, the algorithms has kicked it around, and eventually these algorithms are going to have their faces ripped off unless they change their programs. So, and do their tweak around their correlations. So, And some of them will, some of them won't. The ones that don't will disappear. The ones that do will live to bang around markets on a split second for another day. So I wouldn't be too disappointed. I wouldn't be too concerned about the action in gold in the first few days of this debt ceiling issue. The downgrade in the U.S. debt, and also the Bank of Japan raising its yield. Gold is primarily, not solely, but primarily what I call a short duration asset. Should be more susceptible to short term interest rates, like 1 year, 2 year, 6 months. When you think of it, it doesn't have, gold, as we've been told in the mainstream media many, many times, does not pay a dividend, does not have an interest rate. So as overnight rates go up, it does provide competition for gold. Long bonds, totally different story. It's a totally different mix there. And, I just don't get worked up about when I see gold moving. I don't like it when gold goes down and because the long bond yields are going up. But I know that's just not going to carry the day over the time horizon that I'm looking at, which is a fairly long time horizon when it comes to gold. So I don't try and trade it on a 3-4 month basis. The actual gold itself, I see it as a longer asset that to hold throughout various cycles. I don't trade the cycle, but if you were trading gold based off of business cycles, well then you wouldn't necessarily want to hold it when the Fed's raising rates under normal times. Yeah. So really, if the Fed is near the end of its rate hiking cycle, and we think it probably is pretty close to that, gold, that headwind for gold is probably dying down. But there have been other factors supporting it. And when you think of it, given where the Fed has jacked up rates, you can make the case that gold should have been a lot lower, but it hasn't been. And we've been talking about that for a few months, and a lot of that is due to dollar diversification. No, not de-dollarization. No, we haven't been saying, the dollar is going to be displaced by this thing or that thing. It's not going to be displaced by the renminbi. It's not going to be displaced by a BRIC currency. That's not what the dollar's big problem is. There's a bunch of headwinds facing the dollar. No one headwind is that super strong, but, aside from maybe this downgrade, I think people are starting to realize that is a pretty hefty, headwind heading for the dollar. But generally, there's just a bunch of different cross currents and negative developments for the dollar, and is primarily countries wanting to diversify, countries outside of what I call the NATO bloc, NATO affiliated, NATO friendly countries. They're happy with the dollar, but there's a lot of other countries that are not part of that bloc that just want to diversify. It doesn't mean they're like running out to like get their own kind of reserve currency. It just means they've seen what's happened during the war and they want to diversify. It's kind of risk management. There's actually nothing wrong. I mean, that's pretty rational. And so the dollar bulls who like always kind of, you can get them going by saying, there's this move to move out of some dollars. No, it's not a question of dumping the dollar totally. It's a question of risk management and diversifying. And it's actually a rational move by a lot of these countries, and that's going to be a headwind for the dollar. So don't, I wouldn't worry too much about what's happened here in the first, over the last week or so, with these bond yields going up. It'll be some competition for gold a little bit, but there's many other factors that are going in its favor.
August 22nd, the BRICS will announce some kind of gold-backed currency. What kind of impact do you expect from that?
I'd be shocked if they do that. I don't think that's going to happen.
We'll have more with Ted Dixon right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Ted Dixon. Ted, which jurisdiction in Canada will win the white gold lithium race?
Right, so let's switch to white gold. And, you know, the EV transition is still happening. Whether it happens successfully or not is another story. But in the meantime, we've got governments around the world, both in the G7 and China, are still pushing for it. So those are just the cards that are being dealt for us. Whether one is in favor of EVs or not, there is a big policy push for them. And a lot of money is being thrown around by governments to support the industry. So we've got a race on for lithium, for the batteries for these cars. And Canada is joining that race. We've been a latecomer, but we have some advantages. And the big advantage is that we qualify for subsidies under the Inflation Reduction Act out of Washington, Joe Biden's Inflation Reduction Act. That's a big deal. It means that American automakers can their customers can get tax credit if the car has battery metals from Canada in it. So, cut a long story short. So, Canada is a fine place for lithium exploration, but not every jurisdiction is equal. So I thought, well, who is kind of in the running here to be a major winner of this race? And what I want to look at is new projects that are at the sort of PEA stage, preliminary economic assessment stage, or earlier. Not projects that have already been permitted, waiting for that final permit that basically were developed last bull market in lithium. And in fact, Quebec is probably the leader in that space in terms of mines that were developed last bull market. And we've just seen that the North American lithium mine, it has commercially shipped its first lithium commercially this month. So congratulations to that joint venture. There's another mine, the Galaxy mine, that's waiting for Quebec government approval. It's been given federal approval. So Quebec is kind of winning from last cycle. But how are they doing this cycle? Well, they've generated some interest on the on the hard rock mining side, the Corvette deposit in the Quebec, James Bay area, it's attracted some investment already from a major mining company. So it looks like it's doing pretty good. But the issue with Quebec is permitting slow, and particularly on the provincial end. So, well, I think Quebec's got a really good chance of winning the race. I'd put it kind of down on the show level. I'd put it kind of in third spot as in terms of likely to win, basically because the hard rock mining process takes a long time. And, in terms of, the finish line is really late this decade. I mean, that's when the supply crunch is coming. Supply crunch for lithium, demand supply crunch is going to be kind of late from 2025 to kind of 2030-ish. That's where you want to be able to deliver product into the supply chain. You want to get into those supply chains. If you're too late, you really risk missing the boat here and having your project kind of sit there as all your competitors have come to market and beat you into the supply chains. So Quebec, strong contender, but I'm worried about the permitting and just the economics of getting some of these mines developed. This is going to be somewhat controversial. I think direct lithium extraction, which is a competitor to hard rock mining, has very big potential to win the race, because if it works, and this is the big problem with direct lithium extraction, if it works economically, it does work. Does it work economically? Direct lithium extraction basically is you're taking brine out of the ground and you're separating the lithium from it chemically, and then you're creating lithium hydroxide from that. And you can do that all kind of in a closed process. So it's It's very power intensive, but it's also very clean-ish. Well, I shouldn't say very clean. It's cleaner than a lot of other mining processes, and in terms of emissions. So it's got a lot of potential because the whole cycle. Once you get your DLE facilities built, you can pull the lithium out quite quickly in a matter of hours. And and so it's a very efficient process once you get it going, but it's getting it going economically. Okay, so we are waiting for commercial proof that these work. And there's a number of DLE projects around the world that we'll be watching, but Alberta is kind of leading the pack in Canada. This month, they've announced a publicly traded company has announced the first pilot plant in Alberta that's been constructed. It's not operating yet. They expect it to be operating this month. So we will start to get the first data from Alberta, and they will be pulling lithium out of the Leduc Formation, which is Canada's first oil and gas. Where our first oil wells were discovered. And we will get some very important information from that. But one of the big handicaps for Alberta is beyond the technology and will it work? Because my assumption here is that it will work and the technology will become economically viable. That's a big assumption, and if I'm wrong, then I'm wrong, and Alberta will not make it. But there's also regulatory uncertainty. Again, this is a new area, so even the regulators are trying to figure it all out. And they issued what is called a Directive 90, and unfortunately, it leaves a bit of leeway, a discretion for the regulator as to whether an economic assessment will be needed for a DLE for DLE facilities and network, and that's never a good thing. Like, when as an investor, you want to have some certainty as to what the requirements are for environmental assessments. Like, environmental assessments are not typically, capital enhancing exercises. They usually take a lot of capital and a lot of time. So this Directive 90 is a bit of a downer, in my opinion, for the industry in Alberta. However, we don't know how they're going to implement it yet. So, as more of these companies get closer to doing production, we will get some more certainty from the regulator on how it's going to approach it. So, hopefully for Alberta that it's smooth and that the industry doesn't get weighed down by assessments that could delay them a year or so. And in this game, it's a race. So a year here and a year there, it all starts to add up. Then right next door is Saskatchewan, and they also have direct lithium extraction. They're not as far down the road. There are pilot plants that are popping up in the second half of this year, and we will start getting some catch up from Saskatchewan on direct lithium extraction. And the big advantage right now that I think that Saskatchewan has is not only their formation that they're tapping is not the Leduc formation. It's the formation that they've got in play is it's been able to so far Dupro formation. It's been able to deliver higher grades than the Leduc formation. Again, it's early days, so how pervasive the higher concentrations are, we will find out. But the very interesting element to the Saskatchewan side is that so far, according to one publicly traded company on the Australian Stock Exchange, that they report that the regulators have told them that they will be treating lithium extraction facilities like the oil and gas industry. So that would be a huge advantage to Saskatchewan, as it would likely, and again, until we get to that point in time where a company is ready to build and put these drills into the ground to pull out the lithium brine, do the work, and do the chemical manipulation that's required to extract the lithium, we won't know. But if they proceed like an oil and gas well in terms of the regulatory approach, that should give Saskatchewan a huge advantage, and it will cut about a year off from the development timelines. So right now, I would, in terms of ranking, I would put Saskatchewan at the top of the list to win the race. And it's kind of it's a contentious call, because they are not ahead right now. They are well behind. They're behind the pack. Quebec is probably in the front of the pack. And both Alberta and Saskatchewan are well behind Quebec, if you're talking about a horse race. But I think as we come around the bend here, Alberta and Saskatchewan, we'll have to see how Alberta does. But Saskatchewan looks pretty good. There are other contestants in this race. You can't really talk about Ontario, I think, as a homogeneous place. So that's, I've kind of excluded them from looking at it, because that's worth a discussion all on its own. But look, there are other contenders too. I should say for Saskatchewan, by the way, they also have hard rock mining up north. So this exploration going on for hard rock lithium. So, you know, they've got this kind of added feature where they've got both. So, but look, Northwest Territories is another area where I think on the regulatory side, they have potential. There's hard rock deposits up there. There's only one level of government per se. And Nova Scotia has got some deposits. It's got a pretty decent track record for regulatory management, but it's just not a lot of activity in Nova Scotia, although there are some companies with deposits there. So Nova Scotia is another wild card, and Manitoba as well. There's a few companies that are exploring for lithium there. So Manitoba could be a surprise as well. It's mostly hard rock mining as far as I know right now. So I think the two prairie provinces are the ones to watch, and unfortunately in BC we're not really a player in lithium. And by the time if we do become a player, I think we'll be well behind the pack.
Well, it's pretty typical for BC. Take a look at our ferry system, which never works on a long weekend.
Well, it's not easy always running ferries across that Wandafuca Strait. Maybe we need a bridge, right?
Yes, we do need a bridge.
Maybe one day.
Yeah, Pat McGeer did the study back in the 80s, $1 billion to build the bridge. Some people say you can't do it, but I watched the show Impossible Engineering, a Vancouver engineer who has built bridges in Japan, Nordic regions, in Scandinavia, where they have to contend with icebergs, at Japan shifting tectonic plates. He said going from the mainland to Vancouver Island would be a breeze compared to those places. Unfortunately, the only ferry route in BC that makes any money is the mainland to Victoria, and they don't want to cancel that because it subsidizes everything else.
Right.
Here we go.
There's always a political angle to everything when it comes to that, isn't there? Well, how about that? A surprise, surprise.
Yeah, that 10-lane bridge that would have replaced the Massey Tunnel in British Columbia would have been built by now and been in use. Instead, they're still diddling around and are going to replace a tunnel with another small tunnel.
I'm very skeptical of the argument that it can't be done, but whether it's the best use of money, well, we should at least have a debate on it. That would be a good debate to have. Until then, it's take your chances with the ferries and the food on the ferries for sure.
Yeah, bring your own, Ted.
That's very community and health conscious, Jim. I think that's good advice.
Buy locally and bring it on the boat yourself. Ted, thank you so exactly. much for chatting with us.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
My guest has been Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, Canada's first online financial news and research service. His website, CanadianInsider.com. Find him on Twitter at InkResearch. If you have any questions for Ted or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
comments made on HowStreet.com Radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.